Welcome back to Office Hours. I'm Sarah.
And I'm Kiffer. Today is Lesson 11, Social, Economic, and Political Determinants of Health. And I want to open with the claim, the lesson stakes everything on. The single most consequential finding in social epidemiology is that health follows a gradient. More privileged groups have better health than less privileged groups in roughly linear fashion across the whole social hierarchy.
And the finding is not that the poor are sick and everyone else is fine. It's that everyone on the way up the gradient is sicker than the people above them.
Right. And that finding, which has been replicated in essentially every population studied in every wealthy country with every measure of social position, has profound implications. Addressing health disparities requires addressing the gradient itself, not just the bottom of the distribution.
Let's start with the empirical foundation, the Black Report and the Whitehall studies.
The Black Report, formerly titled Inequalities in Health, Report of a Research Working Group, was commissioned by the UK Labour government in 1977 and published under the Thatcher government in August 1980. Lead author was Sir Douglas Black, president of the Royal College of Physicians. The working group included Cyril Smith, Peter Townsend, and Margaret Whitehead.
And the findings were stark.
Mortality across nearly every cause was substantially higher in lower socioeconomic groups in the UK. The gap between social class B, unskilled manual workers, and social class B, professional workers, was approximately 2.5 times for adult male mortality, similar gradients for women and children. Despite the NHS having operated for over 30 years, at the time of the report, providing universal medical care, the social gradient hadn't narrowed and in some respects had widened.
And the political response?
Telling. The report was released on a UK bank holiday with approximately 260 copies printed, the smallest official print run for a major government health report in modern UK history. The Thatcher government distributed it primarily to academic libraries and didn't make it available to the public through normal channels. It was nonetheless smuggled into wider circulation by sympathetic civil servants and academics and became one of the most influential public health documents of the 20th century. Every subsequent UK health inequalities study has confirmed the findings.
Whitehall is the other foundational study.
Michael Marmot's Whitehall 1 study, initiated in 1967, followed approximately 17,500 male British civil servants for 25 years. Several methodological advantages. Single employer, the UK civil service, stable workforce with low attrition, well-characterized occupational hierarchy with clear grades from junior administrative officer through senior official to permanent secretary, and a population homogeneous on many factors that simplified interpretation.
And the findings reshaped social epidemiology.
Mortality followed a clear stepwise gradient. Men in the lowest civil service grade had roughly 3 times the mortality of men in the highest grade. The gradient was not just bottom versus top, it was stepwise across all 5 grades, and critically, controlling for smoking, blood pressure, cholesterol, BMI, and physical activity reduced, but did not eliminate the gradient. Something about hierarchy itself, Marmot argued, control over work, Fardew was producing health effects beyond what classical risk factors explained.
Whitehall 2 extended the work.
Initiated 1985, with women included. Whitehall 2 measured psychosocial factors, work demands, decision latitude, social support, job security, biological intermediates, cortisol patterns, inflammatory markers, autonomic function. The findings supported Marmot's psychosocial hypothesis. Workers with low decision latitude and high demands had worse cardiovascular outcomes with biological mediation through stress response systems. Whitehall has produced more than 1,000 peer-reviewed publications over nearly 40 years.
And the policy implication is striking?
If the gradient is approximately linear across the social hierarchy, then interventions targeting only the poorest address only the lowest step of the gradient and leave everything above unchanged. Targeted programs improve outcomes for the targeted population, but they don't address the gradient. The Whitehall findings imply that universal interventions, universal healthcare, universal pharmacare, universal child benefits, universal early childhood education, universal pensions, flatten the gradient more effectively than targeted ones. That's one of the underlying empirical arguments for universalism in Canadian and Scandinavian social policy.
And it's worth being clear that universalism doesn't mean targeted programs are useless.
Right. It means targeted programs cannot by themselves address the gradient because the gradient exists at every level. The combination, universal foundations plus targeted supplements where additional interventions needed, is contemporary best practice. Universal programs are also politically more durable because they have broader constituencies. They're administratively simpler, they avoid stigma, and they address the actual mechanism producing the disparity, which is structural inequality itself, not just its bottom tail.
Let's move to the framework, the WHO Commission on Social Determinants.
2005, WHO established the commission, chaired by Michael Marmot, a remarkable set of public health, social policy, and human rights leaders from around the world. Final report, Closing the Gap in a Generation, Health Equity Through Action on the Social Determinants of Health, published in August 2008, canonical reference for social determinants thinking ever since.
And the framework distinguishes three layers.
Structural determinants are the upstream conditions: income, education, gender, race, geography, employment status, political and economic conditions. Intermediate determinants are the conditions through which structural factors operate: material circumstances like housing and working conditions, psychosocial factors like chronic stress and social support, biological factors, and health system factors. Health outcomes are the diseases, disabilities, and deaths that emerge from the cascade. The framework's value is in making the cascade visible. Health disparities are not random or unfortunate. They're produced by specific upstream conditions through specific intermediate mechanisms.
Three overarching recommendations from the commission.
Improve daily living conditions, like housing, work, education, healthcare. Tackle the inequitable distribution of power, money and resources, taxation, labor rights, gender equity, redistribution, and measure and understand the problem. Surveillance of inequalities, evaluation of interventions, substantively ambitious. The 2008 vision of closing the gap in a generation by approximately 2038 is well behind schedule.
Wilkinson and Pickett's spirit level argument is a related thread.
Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett, 2009 book, The Spirit Level, Why Equality is Better for Everyone. The argument was that across high-income countries, income inequality, lying separate from absolute income, predicts a wide range of population health and social outcomes. They examined approximately 21 OECD countries and 50 US states, plotting indicators against income inequality measures. More unequal countries and states had worse outcomes across nearly every dimension: life expectancy, infant mortality, mental illness, obesity, drug use, teenage births, homicide, imprisonment, trust, social mobility.
And the empirical case has been contested.
Critics, Andrew Lee, Christopher Snowden, others, have shown that the cross-country correlations are sensitive to country selection, control variables, and measurement choices. The relationship is weaker within countries than between them, suggesting absolute income matters substantially. Some outcomes, homicide, imprisonment, have stronger inequality associations than others. The strong version of the claim has not been fully established. Contemporary consensus is somewhere between Wilkinson Pickett and their strongest critics. Inequality does predict some outcomes beyond absolute income, particularly for outcomes that depend on social trust and status-related stress. But the effect sizes are smaller than the original book implied.
And then there's the newer framing, political determinants of health.
Sridhar Venkatapuram, Claire Bambra, others through the 2010s. The framing extends social determinants to make the political dimension explicit. The distribution of social determinants is itself a political choice about taxation, labor protections, social programs, environmental regulation, immigration, criminal justice, and how power is distributed across institutions. The empirical case is strong. Countries with more universal social policies, stronger labor protections, more progressive taxation, and more equal distribution of political power have better population health outcomes. The Nordic countries are the clearest example. Their 20th century population health gains cannot be explained without specific political choices about welfare state organization, labor rights, and gender equity.
And the framing is contested within public health itself.
Many public health professionals are uncomfortable with explicit political engagement. Concerns about scientific credibility, perceived neutrality, professional norms against political activism. The countervailing argument is that neutrality on questions like a pandemic response or universal health care is itself a political choice, one that often favors the status quo. The contemporary direction of Canadian public health is toward more explicit engagement with political determinants, though the professional consensus is still developing.
Let's turn to the hardest section of the lesson: racism, colonialism, and Indigenous health.
This is where the course turns most explicitly toward what conventional public health has been slowest to confront. And the lesson is direct about that. The most powerful social determinants of health in Canada, racism and colonialism, are also the ones public health has been slowest to confront.
Racism as a public health issue rests on three categories of mechanism.
Structural racism is racism embedded in laws, institutions, and policies that produce systematic disparities even without individual discriminatory intent. Residential segregation, school funding tied to property tax bases, criminal justice disparities at every stage, occupational segregation. Institutional racism is differential treatment within specific institutions, disparate clinical, employment, housing, lending decisions. Interpersonal racism is the cumulative effect of discriminatory encounters in daily life, with both psychological consequences and direct biological effects through chronic stress activation.
And the empirical evidence?
Substantial. Black mortality in the U.S. consistently exceeds white mortality across nearly every age group and cause of death. The gap is not explained by individual level risk factors. Controlling for income, education, and health behaviors reduces but does not eliminate the disparity. Black women in the U.S. have approximately 3 times the maternal mortality of white women. Black infants have approximately 2 times the infant mortality. Black men have substantially lower life expectancy. The gaps are smaller in Canada, but exist.
Arlene Geronimus's weathering framework.
Weathering proposes that cumulative exposure to racism produces accelerated biological aging through chronic activation of stress response systems. Empirical work on telomere length, allostatic load, inflammatory markers, and epigenetic clocks has supported the framework. Black Americans and other marginalized racial groups have measurably accelerated biological aging compared with white Americans of the same chronological age and similar individual level health behaviors. The weathering findings reframe racism as a measurable physiological exposure with quantifiable biological consequences.
And institutional declarations are now mainstream.
The American Medical Association, the American Public Health Association, the American Heart Association, the American Academy of Pediatrics, and analogous Canadian bodies have all formally declared racism a public health crisis since 2020, produced some institutional change, anti-racism training, expanded data collection by race. The structural responses, housing policy, criminal justice reform, education funding are slower.
Indigenous health and the colonial determinant is where the Canadian story sharpens.
Indigenous peoples in Canada have life expectancies 5 to 15 years lower than non-Indigenous Canadians, with disparities in nearly every disease category. Infant mortality is approximately twice that of non-Indigenous Canada. Suicide rates are dramatically elevated, particularly among Indigenous youth. Diabetes prevalence is approximately 3 to 5 times higher. Tuberculosis rates remain elevated by orders of magnitude in some Inuit communities. The disparities are not abstract. They are catastrophic, measurable, and persistent.
And the cause is colonization. The lesson is specific about the mechanisms.
Residential schools, the federally mandated boarding school system, operated by churches under federal funding from the 1880s through the last closure in 1996, that forcibly separated approximately 150,000 Indigenous children from their families. An estimated 6,000 plus children died in the system. The cultural and intergenerational trauma effects are pervasive. The Indian Act of 1876 has structured Indigenous identity, governance, and rights for nearly 150 years, often in ways that have produced harm. The reserve system concentrated Indigenous populations on small land parcels, often lacking infrastructure. Forced relocations, including the Inuit relocations to the high Arctic in the 1950s. The 60s scoop, the systematic removal of Indigenous children into the child welfare system. And chronic underfunding of First Nations on reserve services.
And the drinking water advisories issue is the contemporary face.
As of 2026, several First Nations communities remain under long-term drinking water advisories, despite the federal government's 2015 commitment to end all such advisories by 2021. The fact that Indigenous communities in one of the wealthiest countries on earth have repeatedly lacked reliable, safe drinking water is a national disgrace and a measurable contributor to health disparities. Most long-term advisories have been lifted. The persistence of any remaining advisories illustrates the inadequacy of the overall response.
The Truth and Reconciliation Commission,
established 2008 as part of the Indian Residential School Settlement Agreement, chaired by Justice Murray Sinclair, with Commissioners Marie Wilson and Chief Wilton Littlechild. Heard testimony from over 6,500 residential school survivors over 6 years. The final report, released in 2015, documented the residential school system as a system of cultural genocide. The 94 calls to action articulate specific steps toward reconciliation.
And calls 18 through 24 address health specifically.
Call 18. acknowledge that the current state of Indigenous health is a direct result of previous Canadian government policies. Call 19, establish measurable goals to close the health gap. Call 20, address the jurisdictional dispute over Aboriginal healthcare responsibility. Call 21, sustainable funding for Aboriginal healing centers. Call 22, recognize the value of Aboriginal healing practices. Call 23, increase Aboriginal health professionals and provide cultural competency training. Call 24, require all medical and nursing schools to include Indigenous health, residential school history, UNDRIP, treaties, and Indigenous teachings.
And the progress has been slow and uneven.
Some progress is real. Indigenous-led research has expanded substantially. The First Nations Health Authority in BC is operational. Several medical and nursing schools are implementing Call 24 requirements. The federal government has increased funding for Indigenous health services. Other progress is limited. The jurisdictional disputes Call 20 addresses remain partly unresolved. Indigenous health disparities have not measurably closed since 2015. The structural conditions producing the disparities, poverty, housing inadequacy, child welfare overrepresentation, remain.
Jordan's principle.
Named for Jordan River Anderson, a Manitoba child who died in hospital because federal and provincial governments disputed which would pay for his care. The principle requires that First Nations children receive needed services without jurisdictional delay. The Canadian Human Rights Tribunal ruled in 2016 that the federal government had been discriminating against First Nations children in child welfare and Jordan's principle services. The ruling has produced substantial reform, though implementation remains contested. Cindy Blackstock and the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society have been central to that advocacy.
Cultural safety and the role of non-Indigenous health professionals.
Cultural safety was introduced by Aira Hapeti Ramsden, a Maori nurse in New Zealand, adopted in Canadian Indigenous health work, particularly through the leadership of the First Nations Health Authority. Cultural safety goes beyond cultural awareness, knowing different cultures exist, and beyond cultural competence, developing skills to work across difference. It locates the source of unsafe care and power asymmetries between providers and recipients. And it requires structural change to address those asymmetries. The recipient of care, not the provider, judges whether the encounter was culturally safe.
And for non-Indigenous health professionals, the role is one of structural support rather than leadership.
Indigenous-led research, Indigenous-controlled data through the OCAP principles, Indigenous health authorities, Indigenous-defined priorities. Non-Indigenous researchers can be allies, collaborators, technicians, funders, and structural change advocates within their own institutions. What they should not do is presume to define the problem, the methodology, or the desired outcome. The TRC calls specifically address research and education and treating them as a curriculum for personal and professional development is one concrete starting point.
The FNHA in BC is the structural example.
First Nations Health Authority, established in BC in 2013, the first Indigenous-controlled provincial-level public health authority in Canada, has produced demonstrable improvements in service delivery and important examples of how Indigenous-led public health can be structured. Other Canadian jurisdictions are watching closely. Yukon and Northwest Territories are in various stages of transitions toward Indigenous-led health authorities. The FNHA model isn't the only valid approach. Different nations and communities may prefer different governance structures, but it has provided proof of concept that structural change is possible.
Let's turn to the final section, health system design as determinant.
The health system itself is a social determinant. The choices a country makes about how to fund, deliver, and govern healthcare affect both health outcomes and the distribution of those outcomes. Canada's Medicare system, born in Saskatchewan in 1947, is the canonical Canadian example.
And the founder is Tommy Douglas.
Tommy Douglas, Premier of Saskatchewan from 1944 to 1961, and first leader of the federal NDP Baptist minister-turned-politician, whose commitment to universal health care came from his own childhood experience. He had nearly lost a leg to osteomyelitis as a child because his family couldn't afford treatment. A Winnipeg surgeon performed the surgery free of charge. Douglas later credited the experience with shaping his political philosophy.
Saskatchewan introduced North America's first universal public hospital insurance in 1947.
Saskatchewan Hospital Services Plan. Universal Physician Service Insurance followed in 1962 under the Saskatchewan Medical Care Insurance Act. The 1962 implementation triggered a doctor's strike that lasted 23 days in July. Doctors closed offices, threatened to leave the province, brought in physicians from the UK and elsewhere to maintain emergency services. the Douglas government held its position. The strike ended with the Saskatoon Agreement, which preserved the universal system while allowing physicians to continue billing patients directly with the government reimbursing the patient. Within months, the system was operational.
And the model spread federally.
The Federal Medical Care Act of 1966 provided federal cost sharing for provincial medical insurance plans that met certain criteria. By 1972, all 10 provinces had Medicare. The 1984 Canada Health Act codified the five principles that have defined Canadian Medicare since: public administration, comprehensiveness, universality, portability, accessibility.
The Canada-US comparison.
International comparisons consistently show the U.S. spends substantially more per capita on healthcare than Canada, roughly twice as much, about $13,000 versus $6,500 in 2023. And yet the U.S. has worse outcomes on most population health indicators, life expectancy approximately 3 to 4 years lower than Canada, maternal mortality approximately 3 times higher, infant mortality approximately 1.5 times higher, preventable mortality substantially higher across most categories.
And the explanations?
Multiple. Administrative overhead. The U.S. private insurance system requires substantially more administrative spending. Higher prescription drug prices. No central price negotiation. Lower primary care density. Fragmented care delivery. And the substantial uninsured and underinsured population, about 8 to 10% uninsured, with substantially more underinsured. The uninsured and underinsured experience substantially worse outcomes.
The Canadian system has its own limits.
Long wait times for some non-emergency procedures, incomplete coverage of pharmaceuticals, dental, vision, mental health, substantial provincial variation. The system is under strain as the population ages and as workforce shortages develop. The comparison is not to declare the Canadian system superior on every dimension. It's to recognize that system design itself is a population health intervention that shapes who gets what care, at what cost, with what outcomes.
And the contemporary expansions are filling some of those gaps.
The Canadian Dental Care Plan launched in 2023 for seniors and expanded to children and other groups in 2024 and 2025, addresses one of the major gaps. The PharmaCare Act of 2024 provides federal support for provincial PharmaCare programs, beginning with universal coverage for diabetes medications and contraceptives. The Canada Child Benefit, introduced in 2016, has reduced child poverty in Canada by approximately 30% since 2015, one of the largest single anti-poverty policy improvements in Canadian history. The child care agreement signed in 2021 and 2022 is implementing $10 a day child care across provinces. Not strictly a healthcare program, but a major social determinant.
Let's bring this together. Takeaways.
Go ahead.
First takeaway. The social gradient in health is one of the most replicated findings in population health research. It operates stepwise across the entire social hierarchy, not just at the bottom. The implication is that addressing health disparity requires structural change to the gradient itself, not just compensating for its bottom tail. Whitehall is the canonical study. Marmot's psychosocial hypothesis that control over work mediates the gradient has substantial biological support.
Second takeaway. The WHO Commission on Social Determinants in 2008 provided the dominant contemporary framework: structural determinants, intermediate determinants, health outcomes. The framework's value is in making the upstream to disease cascade visible. The Commission's three recommendations: improve daily living conditions, tackle inequitable distribution of power and resources, measure and evaluate, remain the operational program.
Third takeaway. Wilkinson and Pickett's spirit-level argument that income inequality predicts a range of health and social outcomes has been hugely influential and empirically contested. The contemporary consensus is that inequality does predict some outcomes beyond absolute income, particularly for outcomes that depend on social trust and status-related stress. But the effect sizes are smaller than the original book implied, and the policy implications are not as straightforwardly redistributive as some readers concluded.
Fourth takeaway. The political determinants framing makes the political dimension of social determinants explicit. Countries with more universal social policies, stronger labor protections, more progressive taxation, and more equal distribution of political power have better population health. Public health that takes social determinants seriously has to engage politically, not just scientifically. The professional consensus on this is still developing, but the direction is clear.
Fifth takeaway, racism is a measurable public health exposure with structural, institutional, and interpersonal mechanisms. Geronimus' weathering framework provides a mechanism by which chronic exposure to racism produces accelerated biological aging. Major medical and public health bodies have formally declared racism a public health crisis since 2020. The structural responses lag the declarations.
Sixth takeaway, Indigenous health disparities in Canada are produced by colonization with specific mechanisms, residential schools, the Indian Act, the reserve system, forced relocations, the 60s scoop, chronic underfunding of on-reserve services. The TRC's calls to action 18 through 24 articulate the health agenda. Jordan's principle, the First Nations Health Authority, and Indigenous-led research are operational responses, but the disparities have not measurably closed since the 2015 TRC report.
Seventh takeaway, the health system is itself a social determinant. The Canadian Medicare system, founded by Tommy Douglas in Saskatchewan in 1947 and codified federally in the Canada Health Act of 1984, has produced measurable population health benefits compared with the U.S. system. Contemporary expansions, dental care, pharmacare, the Canada Child Benefit, child care, are filling some of the historical gaps in universal coverage. The remaining gaps disproportionately affect lower-income Canadians.
Eighth, and the synthesizing thought. The recurring lesson of this lesson is that population health is structurally produced. The conditions in which people are born, grow, live, work, and age, and the political choices that distribute those conditions explain more of population health than any individual-level intervention can. Universal social policy, anti-racism work, decolonization, and progressive economic policy are not adjuncts to public health. They are public health. Public health that takes social determinants seriously eventually arrives at policy frontiers, taxation, labor, immigration, criminal justice, Indigenous self-government that are politically substantive. That's not a bug. That's the discipline.
I want to ask about the methodology piece too. SEP measurement is harder than it sounds.
Yeah. Socioeconomic position is measured along multiple dimensions with different strengths. Education is the most stable single measure across the life course, captured in essentially every health survey. Income measurements include current income, household income adjusted for household size, and lifetime income, each with different relationships to health. Occupation can be measured by job title with classifications like the National Statistics Socioeconomic Classification, NSSEC, or the Erickson-Goldthorpe Schema. Wealth provides a different angle than income, particularly for older populations. Subjective social status, the MacArthur scale, where do you place yourself on a ladder representing social position, predicts outcomes independently of objective SEP. Composite measures combining multiple dimensions have stronger predictive power than any single component.
And the Whitehall studies are an unusually clean methodological case.
Because the British civil service grade structure provided a clear, well-characterized occupational hierarchy that made the stepwise gradient particularly visible. Subsequent population-based studies using education or composite measures have replicated the gradient pattern, but with somewhat different specific findings, partly because the underlying SEP measure differs, and partly because the populations differ. The contemporary methodological frontier includes life course SEP measurement, parental SEP, own early life SEP, current SEP, and trajectories, multidimensional SEP. Contextual SEP from neighborhood census data interacting with individual SEP. Decomposition methods estimating how much of the gradient is explained by specific risk factors.
And measuring racism is its own methodological challenge.
Survey-based instruments are the workhorse. The Everyday Discrimination Scale from Williams and colleagues in 1997 asks about specific discriminatory experiences treated with less courtesy, less respect, and their perceived reasons. The major experiences of discrimination, scale measures lifetime events, not hired, fired, denied promotion, harassed by police. These capture experience racism, but not structural racism, which by definition operates without individuals always recognizing it. Structural measures include residential segregation indices, school funding inequality measures, criminal justice disparity indicators. The combination of experienced and structural measures provides a more complete characterization.
And allostatic load as the mechanism.
Kuhn's framework for cumulative physiological dysregulation. Operationalized as a multi-system biomarker composite, cardiovascular, metabolic, inflammatory, neuroendocrine. The specific operationalization varies, but typically 8 to 15 biomarkers. AL is elevated in Black Americans compared with white Americans at every age and is one of the proposed mechanisms for Geronimus's weathering hypothesis. The framework provides one of the bridges from structural racism to measurable biological consequences.
And Chandler Lalonde's cultural continuity studies are worth a moment.
Beautiful piece of work. They tested whether community-level measures of cultural continuity, self-government, control over education, control over health services, cultural facilities, land claims activity, predicted community-level health outcomes, particularly youth suicide. The findings were striking: near zero youth suicide rates in BC First Nations communities with strong cultural continuity, substantially elevated rates in communities without it. The framework itself came from Indigenous worldview. The research question, does cultural continuity protect, would not have been generated from the mainstream framing. The methodology was relatively simple comparative analysis. The contribution was the research question, which is a useful general lesson about how research questions get framed and what gets seen and not seen.
I want to come back to one more piece, the contemporary forced sterilization of Indigenous women that the lesson mentions.
Yeah, the Alberta and BC Sexual Sterilization Acts were repealed in 1972 and 1973, respectively. But forced sterilization of Indigenous women in Canadian healthcare settings, not under those specific acts, but in regular hospital and clinical encounters, has been documented continuing into the 2000s and 2010s. Investigations by Saskatchewan Senator Yvonne Boyer and journalist Karen Stoat, among others, have laid out the pattern. Coerced or uninformed tubal ligations performed during childbirth or other procedures. Class action litigation is ongoing. This is not a historical issue, it's a contemporary one. And it speaks to why the disability rights and Indigenous rights critique of contemporary medical genetics, which we touched on in Lesson 7, deserves serious engagement rather than dismissal.
And one more thing about the universalism argument and its limits.
Universalism is a powerful framework for flattening the gradient, but it doesn't address differences that aren't reducible to social class. Indigenous health disparities require Indigenous-specific responses. Indigenous-controlled health authorities, decolonized governance, sustained reconciliation work that universal programs cannot substitute for. Racism produces health effects that universal access to healthcare doesn't fully address because the encounter inside the universal system can be racist. The general lesson is that universalism is necessary but not sufficient. The Canadian Medicare system is a foundational achievement, and it hasn't eliminated Indigenous health disparities or racism within healthcare. Both kinds of work, universal and identity specific, are needed.
Final lesson next time. Disability, diversity, and integrating the foundations. The closing of the course.
And it brings together every thread we've worked through. Looking forward to it.
Take care, everyone.